KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Inner Richmond.
Lower Haight.
Burlingame.
Mission.
Potrero Hill.
Coming up, who are the real first responders when a drug user overdoses?
So people tend to use drugs with other drug users. They don't use drugs with police officers and their parents.
Saving lives during the opioid epidemic. Then we'll learn how theater groups joined together to tackle some of Oakland's biggest issues.
We wanted the piece to not be like a propaganda-style activist piece, but rather a piece that asks questions.
And we'll hear the eclectic cultural mix behind the band Locura.
What style of music do you play? You know, do you fit into this nice, neat box? It's always a hard one to answer because we take little bits of everything.
Mixing it up today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Unintentional overdose deaths from prescription opioids have quadrupled in the U.S. since 1999. That's according to the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Opioids are a class of drugs that include pain medications like morphine or hydrocodone, as well as street drugs like heroin. Cities around the country are looking for new ways to fight this increase in overdose deaths, but San Francisco has a long history of dealing with the issue. For almost a decade, an organization called the Dope Project has given drug users the power to save their own lives with an anti-overdose drug called naloxone. Mary Lee Williams reports.
Sign in for me right here. Just...
what it's under?
It's syringe access night at Glide Church in San Francisco's Tenderloin District. And volunteer Kevin Smith is refilling a prescription for Jana Lee. Lee isn't her real last name. She preferred to remain anonymous. Every Tuesday, from 7 o'clock to 9, anyone can come in to get their free longs, bee stingers, and, in Lee's case, a naloxone refill. She used her last dose of the anti-overdose drug this morning to save her friend's life.
He's really cutting down on his usage, but but he gets really strong stuff when he does get it, and he's been going out. Like, he's been OD'ing.
The man Lee saved this morning overdosed on heroin.
Did you end up doing any of the like sternum rubs or before applying? Or?
Rubbing someone's sternum in the middle of their chest is a common way to check if someone is having an overdose or just nodding off. After trying the sternum rub, Lee realized her friend was having an overdose, and she put her naloxone to use. Rather than injecting it, she used a nasal device. She says she's not comfortable using a syringe.
I am insecure about that I'll be able to get that drawn up out of that vial in the right amount of time, in a good amount of time. That is what I'm totally afraid of.
But on Tuesday night, they'd run out of nasal injectors.
Yeah, all we have are the musclers today. And I don't know if you've seen these kits.
A muscler basically means a large syringe. And it's used to inject naloxone into the thigh muscle.
And so I'll give you up to the day. This will
be
all right.
Glide and four other syringe access programs in the city get their supply of naloxone from the DOPE Project, which stands for Drug Overdose Prevention and Education. They collaborate with the San Francisco Department of Public Health.
It's just pure public health.
Eliza Wheeler is the project manager.
You give people this tool, you teach them how to use it, they avert a death.
The DOPE Project buys the naloxone and makes sure it gets to the organizations like Glide and their volunteers, who then give it to people like Lee. They use what's called a standing order. It means a doctor only needs to write one prescription, but that prescription allows people who are trained but not medically certified to give out the drug. They've been doing it this way since 2010. Prior to that, a doctor or nurse practitioner had to be physically present to refill and issue naloxone prescriptions. Wheeler says this has dramatically increased the amount they can distribute.
I mean, we went from giving out naloxone for about 14 hours a month. So it was like 7 2-hour sites throughout the month where you could get naloxone to, I mean, now we give out naloxone
a lot more. Over 350 hours per month, available for drug users at all drop-in sites. Wheeler points out that When it comes to overdoses, opioid users or people close to drug users are the real first responders.
So people tend to use drugs with other drug users. They don't use drugs with police officers and their parents, for the most part. Also, drug users had been witnessing overdoses and responding to overdoses for as long as there were drug overdoses.
Wheeler herself has used it several times over her 20 years of needle exchange and harm reduction work. Harm reduction is a philosophy that's about making drug use safer for those who are unable or unwilling to stop. The focus is on reducing negative consequences rather than trying to stop people or punish them for drug use. Wheeler says some people are so scared of punishment that they might not contact first responders in an overdose situation.
That's a powerful, it's powerful fear, powerful distrust of a system, you know, that is very real for people.
She's personally seen cases where an overdose is occurring, but people are too scared to call 911.
I've heard parents, like not drug users, parents afraid to call 911 for their child, would rather have their own naloxone to revive their kid who struggles with substance use than call 911 because they're just afraid of how their kid will be treated or will they be arrested, and they don't want them to go to jail.
Jana Lee didn't call 911 Tuesday morning when her friend overdosed.
Within the space of a week and a half, he's gone through three doses.
While getting her naloxone refill, Lee has to provide some information about what the anti-overdose drug was used for, who the drug was used on, and what opioids they were using. Kevin Smith, the Glide volunteer, jots down the information in a large three-ring binder.
Yeah, we're just curious, only for just sort of stats for the city.
The DOPE Project and the San Francisco Department of Public Health use this data for research on the effectiveness of the program. Between 2010 and 2015, reported overdose reversals in San Francisco increased fourfold. Though it's hard to know what this number actually means. Is it because there's just more drug usage now? Or are they just doing a better job tracking the naloxone they give out? Regardless, Wheeler says for her, there's no question the program is worth it.
I mean, to me, it's like if it costs $1 million, it would still be a cost-effective thing. But that's, I mean, we spend $1 million in this world on a whole lot less than a human life. So,
she says reversing an overdose is not just about the person whose life is saved, but it's also about the impact on the person who administered the naloxone.
Where you'll hear stories of, you know, oh, I saved someone. I can't believe I saved someone. I was like a superhero, you know. Maybe for that moment, they feel slightly less like a piece of trash, which is what the world treats them as for most of their waking hours, you know.
Jana Lee echoes this idea. She says being able to save her friend's life has definitely had an impact on her.
But, yeah. At least you know that, you know, there's a good reason for you to be on the planet still, because you can help someone else.
The emotional impact of saving someone's life hasn't been quantified or studied. But the DOPE Project isn't focused on that. It's just getting naloxone out there to the people who need it. In San Francisco, I'm Mary Lee Williams for Cross Currents.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hena Baba. When Oakland theater company Ragged Wing Ensemble first started making work in 2004, they were renting space show by show. Eventually, they made themselves a permanent home in downtown Oakland, creating a shared art space they call the Flight Deck. It's now home to four resident theater companies and hosts performances, classes, workshops, and a gallery. The show running now at the Flight Deck brings all four resident companies together. Overnight, a play in three stories explores ideas of gentrification and displacement. Ragged Wing Ensemble's executive director Anna Schneiderman came in to speak
speak with KALW's Jen Cheehan about how the play came about and what it's like to collaboratively produce art.
Your company's work seems to be really informed by some principles that go beyond the stage. So things like rotating and sharing leadership roles, mm-hmm. gender parity in terms of the playwrights you work with, some form of collective decision making. Can you talk about how your philosophical viewpoints inform the art making?
Yeah, we are an ensemble. And for us, it doesn't mean that there's no hierarchy. It means that there's a fluid hierarchy. So people take on certain leadership roles for certain projects, and then there'll be kind of a period where we do something called creative development, where we all get together and there'll be a leader who's kind of crafting the session. But then everybody is just putting in their ideas, whatever art form they come from or whatever kind of expertise they bring. We really value the people and the relationships, and we invest in long-term relationships with each other. So that's part of what it means to be an ensemble to us, is to really invest in actual human beings and the longevity of those relationships. And, you know, each project builds upon that, but we're not starting from scratch with a whole new group of people every time.
Can you talk to me about your performance space and the Flight Deck? Mm-hmm. It's a space in Oakland, and it's a shared space with other theater and performance companies.
Ragged Wing, basically we got to the point where we just didn't have a venue. We didn't have anywhere to do our work. And then we realized that it was kind of a bigger problem than just our company. We started asking around and talking to people and realized that it was just a hole in the regional arts ecosystem. There just wasn't a 99-seat Black Box Theater in Oakland. So we put out this big survey. We found out that there were a bunch of other companies in our same situation. We got a couple groups together. We created this share model where, so Ragged Wing Ensemble is the master tenant. You know, we hold the lease, we run the space. Our staff manages the space and we take responsibility for it. But we have, in addition to us, we have three other resident companies. So Gritty City Repertory Youth Theater, the Lower Bottom Players, and Theater Illuminous. And we all share space there. And that's just the resident companies. Then we have a bunch of member organizations and individual members, and then we rent the space as well. So right now there's 17 arts organizations that make their home at the Flight Deck. We have these kind of concentric circles of involvement, you know, folks that are really, really involved and participating in creating the culture of the place and building the policies and how it all works, and then people who are kind of another level removed and then another level removed. But we see, we support the work of hundreds of artists and tens of thousands of audience members every year at this point. But yeah, the ensemble principles that Ragged Wing was founded on make their way into how we run the Flight Deck. So it's not an official collective in a legal sense, but it is. There are principles of that type of functioning that we bring into how we work. So we have a Flight Deck Council meeting where we all meet monthly and talk about what's going on and create policy and create culture and all invest in the space and, you know, all kind of take it on as our home.
The new piece that you're premiering, it's mm-hmm. called Overnight. It's a collaboration with the resident companies of the Flight Deck. So can you tell me a little bit about that process of all working together on one piece?
Yeah, we have been cohabitating at the space for 3 years now, but we thought, you know, let's go the next step and actually create a show together. So I came up with the idea for the show. The inciting incident is that there's a huge tower that appears overnight. And the idea is each of the companies is creating a play with a different set of characters that all responds to the same inciting incident.
And you're talking about like an office tower.
Office tower
building.
Or residential tower. Yeah, like a large building, mm-hmm. Which is kind of what's happening in Oakland right now, except not
Can
quite
feel
that fast.
Like it,
but
right.
Yeah, exactly. Something that we all care about, that we're all invested in. And so, and we all make our home in this place. And so so it was something that we all had something to say about. But yeah, it's really fascinating and challenging because each of these companies, of course, is used to working independently. And the other thing is we're really trying to make it, it's not just really a set of one acts. It's a complete evening that is going to feel like a full-length play, but it has parts, right? Mm-hmm. It's like puzzle pieces that fit together. And so we're all really invested in that idea and trying to
figure out how to
get this balance between like unity and autonomy and making sure that the piece really represents each of the companies, which each company has a really pretty different aesthetic than each other.
What kind of conflicts did you run into or did you in trying to put the piece together and maybe
differing ways that you, the individuals or the companies might be thinking about things like gentrification and displacement?
Mm-hmm. We all kind of agreed from the beginning that we wanted to say what we wanted to say, but we wanted the piece to not be like a message theater or kind of propaganda style activist piece, but rather a piece that asks questions and lets the audience come to their own conclusion. So it definitely has a viewpoint and a perspective. And then because the piece is so kind of kaleidoscopic in nature, it allows each viewpoint to be maybe extreme because there are many viewpoints presented. Conflicts that have come up have more been about process because we have different ways of doing things. And Ragged Wing is very used to this process where we don't necessarily have a script finished when we start the process. And we hire designers and they start designing towards unfinished scripts. And we have workshops and there's feedback. And the kind of being in the unknown or a place of uncertainty is very comfortable, actually, for Ragged Wing. And for some of the other companies, they were like, how do we even do this?
What are you doing?
Yeah, if we don't have a finished script. It was like very alien to some of these other artists.
I'm thinking about like when a lot of roommates live in a house together and they try to get together and make a meal or something like that when they're used to doing their own thing.
Yeah, it is kind of like that. And there was this kind of one big moment where everybody kind of realized that it was Ragged Wing Ensemble that was kind of producing it and sort of holding the frame. And everybody was kind of like, oh, is that okay? But then we sort of talked
meaning
through
a question of whether it should be more of a true collective.
Yeah, yeah. Or whether it was like the flight deck. But it's not really possible, at least at this point. Somebody has to produce the show, right? Somebody has to get the funding. Somebody has to do all the financial stuff. Somebody has to like hold the basic frame for it. And so we decided that Ragged Wing Ensemble is holding the frame for this one. And as soon as everybody really understood that, it was okay, and it was sort of this notion of like, okay, Ragged Wing is holding the frame for this one, but maybe sometime in the future, someone else will hold the frame and we'll be all be happy to participate in that.
Mm. A lot of relationship things, as soon as it's made clear, if it's made specific, people can feel more comfortable about it.
Yeah.
As long as it's not an unspoken power struggle.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which is something that I encountered in a lot of ensembles that I work with before Ragged Wing.
Unspoken power
struggles.
Right,
where they're like, there's no power dynamic. There's no hierarchy. And I was like, you know,
there always is.
There always is. So let's just call it what it is and be clear about it and then decide if we want to do like some rotation or something like that.
That was Executive Director of Theater Troupe Ragged Wing Ensemble, Anna Schneiderman, speaking with KLW's Jen Chien. Overnight, we'll be playing at the Flight Deck in downtown Oakland through April 22nd. Find all the information at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. The San Francisco band Locura reflects the Bay Area's mix of cultures and histories. Locura blends flamenco, Cuban son, reggae, cumbia, and ska to make its own revolutionary party music. And the band has a concert coming up later this week. In this edition of Bay Area Beats, we'll hear from lead singer Kata Miletic and guitarist Bob Sanders about how they blend to create.
I was born and raised in Spain. My father was a Californian who came there and met my mother, ended up staying 20 years, and then we moved to Italy. And at some point after I graduated high school, I came to the U.S.
Almost every member of the band has a cultural heritage that is from somewhere else.
For me, I think the Locura sound evolved parallel to both Bob and I's own personal musicianship.
The only genre that we intentionally set out to do was rumba flamenca.
And then as we met musicians that were coming from, you know, Afrobeat traditions and salsa and cumbia, well then that, of course, and being in the Bay, being surrounded by so much diversity and so many different styles of music, that's how I see the sound evolving.
Con esta canción, como la indígena, y de cada tierra, sí, de cada tierra.
So Con el Viento was a song that was inspired by thinking about this kind of resurgence of my Spanish identity here in California, because I'd been away from Spain for so many years. So that song is a song for kind of honoring my coming here and all the people who've come through here and all the stories that we carry within us.
Abre la puerta, abre la ventana, con el viento venimos. Abre la puerta, abre la ventana, con el viento venimos.
The concept of ida y vuelta is a concept that really inspires us in Locura, and ida y vuelta means the going and coming back, so round trip, essentially. It's this idea of songs and traditions and styles of music that traveled with the people coming from Spain, the sailors, you know, the colonizers and the Africans to Las Americas, and those traditions mixing here with the indigenous folk here and the different styles and traditions here. And then, you know, from Cuba going back to Spain and then getting incorporated into flamenco.
The idea that we have flamenco now as this pure art form that stands by itself is false, because the only reason it exists is because it has mixed over so many years of so many styles. The song Que Falta was born sitting in the rehearsal studio with our bass player Izzy, who's heavily influenced by Afrobeat and funk, and he had an idea for this riff that opens the song. And then we just kept coming up with all these different musical variations, and we taught that music to the rest of the band, and Kata put her lyrics to it. So that's a great example of a song that it's funk influenced. You get into the verse, you've got a salsa groove. You get into the chorus, it goes to a timba swing, and then it goes back to funk for the bridge section, some drum breaks. That's quintessential Locura.
Name my fears and sing them to the sea.
We and I do feel pressure to, you know, just kind of categorizing Locura. What style of music do you play? You know, do you fit into this nice, neat box of flamenco or, you know, timba or reggae? Or are you a rock band? Are you an indie band? You know, what kind of style do you fit in? And it's always a hard one to answer because we don't really fit into any of those categories. You know, we take little bits of everything.
From what I see being in the music scene here, it's very apparent that that's what bands do in the Bay Area.
Manzanilla, rezo de la mañana. Manzanilla, pa curar el alma y despertar rojo el corazón.
I can't just get into one style. Just as I can't just sing lyrics in English or just sing lyrics in Spanish. And so in one way, I don't want to fit into any box. I want to continue to cultivate the style of music that finds a common ground between different styles, you know, whether it's the African roots, whether it's the indigenous roots of here, of different places, and find how different styles of music really can fit in with each other and groove.
That was Kata Miletich and Bob Sanders from the San Francisco-based band Locura. They spoke with KALW's Jen Chien, who produced that piece. Locura will join fellow Bay Area musical groups Bang Data and Rupa and the April Fishes at a benefit concert at La Peña Cultural Center in Berkeley. That's Friday, April 14th. Find more information at KALW.org and click Cross Currents. And that wraps up Cross Currents for today. Our team includes Lila Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Jeremy Jew, Lisa Morehouse, Ted Muldoon, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Carrie Spivak, and Andrew Stelzer. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Chien, who was just all over today's show. Our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is from the newest album by Danny Paul Grody. The SF Weekly named it one of the best five Bay Area albums of 2016. Grody is scheduled to perform Saturday at the Land and Sea Performance Space in Oakland. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.